As educators prepare for the start of a new school year, they review their curriculum to make sure they have the right instructional game plan in place. Parents make sure their kids are ready to go with the right gear and supplies. College students take stock of what they need for their dorm rooms and classes. But it's also a great time for a back-to-school review for your own personal finances, ensuring you're on track to finish the financial year without any surprises. Welcome to Route 51. I'm Shereen Seward. Today, we take you through a back-to-school financial checkup with Kevin McKinley, owner of McKinley Money, LLC. Kevin is an independent registered investment advisor with offices in Madison and Eau Claire. He is author of the book, Make Your Kid a Millionaire. Kevin, welcome back to the Wisconsin Public Radio.
Hello, Shereen.
So good to talk to you again. It's been a while.
I'm glad to be here. Thank you for having me.
Our phone lines are open for personal finance questions, whether you're thinking about investing or budgeting, estate planning, retirement, anything in between. You can join the conversation calling us at 800-780-9742 or email route51@wpr.org. And Kevin is here to answer those questions. Kevin, this has been a pretty challenging year financially for many people. So in a nutshell, I guess my biggest question is, are we headed for a recession or have we successfully averted that as inflation has finally begun to slow?
Yeah, I wouldn't guess we've averted it yet, in part because the Federal Reserve is doing everything they possibly can to raise interest rates up and cut inflation down, and that can provide a lot of economic pain. And if I had to guess, the Federal Reserve is probably okay with a little bit of economic pain because they are more concerned about rampant inflation. And we're, you know, rampant inflation is really a tax on everybody who spends money because our wages generally aren't going up as fast as inflation is. And we really notice it more quickly because we go to the, you know, the supermarket and a gallon of milk is $4.99. We remember it being $2.99 or $3.99. And it just seems like it, the prices keep going up. So the hope is to avoid a recession and cut inflation. My guess is we're probably going to err on the side of cutting inflation, which makes it more likely that we may see an economic slowdown.
If the Fed raises interest rates, does that mean more expensive borrowing costs across the board automatically?
Not necessarily so. Sometimes different institutions that are lending money might say, you know what, we can actually make a profit at this particular interest rate. And so just because the Federal Reserve has raised interest rates, it doesn't necessarily mean that your borrowing costs will increase. But because the trillions of dollars in the United States and even more money globally is so tied together now, it can't help but have some kind of insidious effect on other interest rate, where the Federal Reserve raises interest rates, banks have to start charging more on mortgages, credit card companies start charging more, et cetera, and it just kind of works through the flow of the system.
How do those decisions by the Fed affect the stock market?
Generally, the Federal Reserve is the biggest determinant of stock prices in the broad sense and over the very long term, because most people, and many people are doing this right now, are looking at higher interest rates on safe investments like CDs and treasuries and seeing 5% in short-term investments and 4% for longer ones. And they're saying, you know what, for the amount of risk involved and uncertainty in the stock market, if I can get 4 or 5%, I'm not going to take the chance on trying to get a greater return by investing in the stock market. I'm just going to park it at the bank or buy some treasuries. It's kind of like, you know, if you're driving somewhere on the freeway, you realize you're way ahead of schedule, and you just decide, you know what, I'm going to get over in the right lane. I'm going to go 65 miles an hour. I might stop for a cup of coffee and to stretch my legs while people from Illinois zoom by you in the left lane in 85 miles an hour.
Well, let's talk about that a little bit. I mean, with interest rates higher than they've been in a long time, investors might be tempted to take their money to the bank. Is that a good idea? I mean, how should investors and savers take advantage of the situation right now?
Yeah, we haven't seen these numbers for about 20 years in the terms of the kinds of yields available right now. It's a little bit because of the Federal Reserve raising interest rates. A smaller portion of it is because the United States is a little more precarious in terms of the amount of debt the United States owes. But as I mentioned, we've seen 5% on a 12-month treasury right now, over 4% on a 10-year treasury. And some people might wonder why that is. Usually we're used to getting a higher rate of return for depositing our money over a longer term than we are on the shorter term. But this is known as an inverted yield curve. And it means interest rates are higher on investments in the short term than they are in the long term. And this has preceded recessions often in before, meaning that the economy slows down and interest rates drop in general as well.
What about borrowing against your home equity? It seems like that's a more attractive option right now.
It is for people, especially if they have a big project coming up. You know, a lot of people, you might be in a home that you like and you like the situation, but you just need to update it, make it bigger, improve it, whatever. And you might have either the house paid for or you have a mortgage that's in the 3 or 4% range. So you don't really want to go back with a big refinancing of the whole mortgage. But you've built some equity up in the house. You can borrow against that equity right now. You're going to pay a decent interest rate. It's about 8% or so. But if you have a big project, you can get a lump sum right up front. And then you can slowly pay off the principal and interest, usually over about a 10-year period. And so for people who are kind of struggling with coming up with cash, looking at a home equity loan for a big project is a good idea.
We're talking with Kevin McKinley, our guest today, discussing making the most of your money. Your questions are welcome. 800-780-9742. You can email route51@wpr.org as well. Student loan payments are resuming soon. There was a pause for a few years. People kind of got used to that, you know, not having to make that payment. Some of those payments are pretty high. What do you recommend people do to prepare for this? And is there a way to reduce those larger payments?
Absolutely. Especially on federal student loans, which are my favorite kind of student loans, whether they're subsidized or unsubsidized, there still is a slower income-based repayment plan that can cut the required payment down quite a bit. You know, usually if you have a loan and it needs to be paid off, let's say in 10 years, you usually have to make a payment that's about 1% of the outstanding balance each month before you can retire that debt within 10 years. So if you owe, let's say, $30,000 in student loans, which is about the average amount owed by students who borrow money for an undergraduate education, normally their payments would be about $300 per month over 10 years' time. However, due to the recent changes to the SAVE program, you can lower that payment down significantly. So even someone who makes maybe $30,000 or $40,000 a year can lower that payment down to about $50 or so, depending on their status and where they live, and still keep the loan current. And then after you've made those payments for a certain period of time, the federal government will forgive whatever balance is owed.
As you mentioned, there are different types of student loans, and sometimes financial aid packages don't cover the whole cost for college students. Parents might not have been able to plan ahead. And are private loans a good idea? Is this something that people should look at?
They can be a good idea. They're not as favorable as the subsidized and unsubsidized federal loans because you will generally not get any loan forgiveness eventually on the private loans. And the private loan companies can be okay to work with, but they're still not as easy to work with as the government loans. So if people say that they're going to go for higher education, which I totally applaud, especially if you have a career path in mind that can help you pay for the borrowing, you're going to have to look at the federal loans first by filling out the FAFSA, and you can borrow anywhere between $3,500 and $7,500 per year, and that is dependent upon your age and the type of loan that you're getting and where you're at in the university program. Freshmen can borrow less, seniors can borrow more, and so yeah, definitely start with the federal subsidized loans, and then if you need more, look at some of the private lenders out there. Again, it's not the best option. I'd much rather have the student borrow the money rather than the parent, and I'd also much rather have people borrow money for the education specifically via education loans rather than tapping their home equity line of credit or a home equity loan, just because you want to keep that home equity loan and line of credit in reserve just in case you need to borrow that in the future. And it's a lot easier to get an education loan than it is to get a home equity loan or line of credit.
800-780-9742, the number to call, and email is route51@wpr.org with your financial questions for Kevin. There are a lot of kids heading off to college in the next few weeks here, and some wind up getting a big chunk of money back. You know, they get this financial aid package, and it's more than they actually need. That money is meant to help them live throughout the school year. So what advice would you give to college students to make sure they're managing that money responsibly?
Well, first of all, track your spending right away. That's a very important thing when people are going off. You know, it's no different than when I went off into college back in the 1920s. You know, the first thing I did was order a pizza every single night, and then I went back home after a few weeks, and people didn't recognize me because I had bloated up like the Stay Puft Marshmallow Man. It's the same thing with finances. You want to keep some control on it, and you want to manage it, because if you get into any trouble, first of all, your parents are probably going to be pretty upset with you, and second of all, it can really damage your credit rating quickly at a very crucial time in your life, because your credit score can affect not only whether or not you can borrow money, but also how much it will cost you to borrow that money, and it can even affect, you know, your job prospects. It can affect your insurance costs, etc. So definitely monitor everything. Pay off your credit cards right away, and you'll be very surprised at how quickly your credit score goes from nothing, because there's really no history on you, up to a very good number, which in Wisconsin is usually about 750 on a typical credit score.
Is there a good rule of thumb for how much education debt is too much?
Yeah, absolutely. I'm glad you brought that up. You know, a lot of people pursue higher education. They pursue very noble endeavors in terms of their profession or their major or whatever, but then they find out that they borrowed too much money based on the employment prospects available. So I came up with a rule of thumb as to how much money is a decent amount of money or a maximum amount of money you might want to borrow for your education. And what you should do is take the typical starting salary for a major and then multiply it by the employment rate for the people who are graduating from that particular school in that particular major. And the school should be able to provide that information. And if they don't, you might want to look at a different school. So let's say you're planning on being a nurse and you find out that the school you're thinking of going to, that nurses typically make, let's just say $50,000 a year to start out. And the school says, well, 90% of our nursing school graduates start out with a job right after graduation. You take the $50,000 starting salary, multiply it by that 90% employment rate to get $45,000. And as kind of just a rough rule of thumb, that means you wouldn't want to borrow more than $45,000 totally to get that particular job from that particular school.
You're listening to financial advisor Kevin McKinley on Route 51, and we'll take your money questions too. You can call us 800-780-9742, or you can email route51@wpr.org. I'm Shereen Seawart. This is Route 51 on Wisconsin Public Radio. Thanks for joining us on Route 51. I'm Shereen Seawart. Financial advisor Kevin McKinley is our guest today as we continue our discussion about making the most of your money for the rest of 2023. It's a back-to-school financial checkup. So what would you like to know? You can call us 800-780-9742 or email your questions to us at route51@wpr.org. Kevin, before we move on from school stuff, I want to ask you about 529 savings plans. If you're a parent or grandparent who wants to help put a child through school, this is a plan that we hear a lot about. How do you find the right one, and what happens if the child decides not to go to college?
You know, generally, 529 plans are kind of like Roth IRAs, except saving for college. Just about anybody can open up a 529 for anybody else and then deposit money into it. They don't get a federal income tax break usually. Wisconsin residents can get a small state income tax break on deposits to the EdVest account. So if you are a Wisconsin resident, that's the one I would recommend you start with, the EdVest account. And then the money grows, hopefully, and sheltered from taxes. And then once the intended beneficiary is ready to go off to some form of higher education, absolutely does not have to be four-year college or anything like that, the money can be withdrawn tax-free to pay for qualified higher education expenses. And the money generally does not, that's in the account, doesn't usually affect the need-based financial aid package that schools might award a great deal. So it's a good way for parents or grandparents to keep control over the money, only use it for education expenses, which can also be, you know, not just tuition and books, but it can be room and board up to a certain extent. And then usually, if the money is not used for a qualified expense, oftentimes what parents or grandparents will do is roll it over to another family member who might need it more down the road, or they can just leave it in there. There's generally no expiration date on the account. But if for some reason there's an emergency, or let's say the kid graduates or just leaves school and needs some money to survive, you can pull the money out of the 529 program and you will pay taxes on the earnings plus a 10% penalty on the earnings. But there are some ways that you can legally manipulate the distributions and ownership of the account to reduce the amount of taxes that you'd pay on the earnings.
I'm glad you brought up taxes, because there is a story in Wall Street Journal that caught my eye this week saying that investors have put more than $9 billion into money market funds in about a five-week span. Now, here's the lead from the story. Americans are taking advantage of higher returns on their treasury bills and other fixed income investments. That joy might be dampened when they see their tax bills. So what can investors do to avoid the shock of a surprise bill next spring when tax time comes around?
Well, taxes generally are a wonderful problem to have. Usually it means something good happened in your financial life. It means you made money by earnings or by interest on savings or capital gains, by selling an asset or selling a property. And so, I don't begrudge taxes. That's part of a functioning society. I just want to pay as little as I legally can. And one way to do it is making sure that you have all of your money in the proper jars. And so if you have the luxury of an IRA or a Roth IRA or 401k that you can purchase investments that pay interest, those will shelter the money from taxes. And, you're eventually going to pay taxes on the withdrawals likely from a 401k or an IRA, not from a Roth IRA. And so if you're saving money and you say, I don't want to pay any taxes on it, you could open a Roth IRA if you have earned income or you're married to someone who does, and then you can deposit that money into a CD or something like that, and the CD will pay, again, it's not uncommon right now to find 5% interest on short-term CDs, and as the interest comes in, it'll be sheltered from taxes. Of course, when you pull it out before age 59 and a half from the Roth IRA, it could be taxed, and there may be a penalty on it. But otherwise, just be ready for it. Again, you've earned the interest. So when the interest is credited to your account, the bank or the credit union or the brokerage firm will send you a tax form at the end of the year that says you've earned this amount of interest. You're going to owe probably somewhere between 10 to 40% of that amount in taxes on it. So just be ready for it. Don't spend all of your interest and expect that it's probably going to come into play.
Kevin McKinley is our guest. 800-780-9742 is the number to call. You can email questions to Route51@WPR.org. I want to ask you a little bit about the stock market. We touched on this a little bit ago. What's the state of the stock market right now? Are we on solid ground or are things kind of crazy?
Yes and yes. The stock market is always going to be volatile. There is always going to be some kind of danger out there, near term, long term, etc. That's been true for hundreds of years of stock market investing in the United States, and it will continue to be true for the rest of our lifetime. In fact, usually the better things look in the world and economically, typically that's denoted a high in the stock market. So the worse things are going around you, the better time it is to buy. The better things look generally and in the world and economically, usually the worst time that is to buy. And so usually that you're going to have some kind of fear like that. It's going to be, that's part of the reason why people who can't afford to lose money really shouldn't be investing in the stock market, especially right now, because they can get decent rates of return on very safe money. Now, people who are investing for retirement, whether you're saving in your 401k or you're open to a Roth IRA or an IRA, if you have 30 years until retirement, you can afford the risk involved in the stock market and the volatility. for what is hopefully a higher rate of return than what you could get on safe money over that same period of time. But again, you have to have a decades-long attitude about it, because otherwise you're going to be very disappointed in a particular year when it can drop 20%, and no one should be surprised by that.
I'm going to be asking you about retirement strategies soon, but continuing on the stock market, a lot of people try this do-it-yourself approach with apps like Robinhood, Webull. I mean, there's a bunch of them now. What do you think about that? Is that a smart way to use them, or is it too risky?
Well, I love the notion of people being able to do their investing themselves. And there's never been a better time to do that, but there is, you know, so much information out there, it's hard to know what to believe. Those apps out there, that's just legalized gambling. And the same dopamine rush people get from going to a casino is what they get from buying a stock on an app and then selling it 10 minutes later for a $2 profit. And so that's not investing in my mind. That's gambling. If you're comfortable with gambling, by all means, use those apps to trade stocks. Otherwise, there are better ways to invest for the longer term. And I've done this as a financial advisor now for 35 years. So I'm starting to get the hang of it. And one thing I've noticed is that the people who check their portfolios the most usually are the ones who are least likely to make money in the stock market over the long term, because they're always getting excited or getting nervous or whatever. They always feel like they lose money if something drops a little bit in value. The ones who say, you know what, this makes sense for me, I'm going to put my money into it, I'm not going to check it later today, I'm not going to check it tomorrow, I might monitor it every year or so, those are the ones who have typically done better by investing in the stock market than the people who watch it every single second of every single day.
I have to wonder, have you seen the trailer for this new movie that's coming out called Dumb Money? It's the one that's based on the GameStop financial saga and the stock frenzy?
I'm familiar with the story, yes.
Okay, I mean, so they're making a movie out of this thing. And I mean, how did that kind of David versus Goliath thing even happen? And do you think we could see it happen again?
No, absolutely. We've seen it all the time. It's just because of the beauty and ugliness of the internet, this information can be spread immediately over to millions of different people. And when someone starts to believe in one person, follows them on Twitter or Instagram or whatever, and then buys their investment recommendation, generally that's going to drive the price up. That's usually not the best way to make money. Again, it's more like gambling. And the problem is that if you're not, you know, it's almost like a pyramid scheme, in the sense that if you're not one of the first people to buy based on a certain social media influencer's investment recommendation, and you're more towards the end of it, you're likely going to be the one holding the bag.
Kevin McKinley is with us and stays with us for the rest of the hour. The number to call is 800-780-9742. Email questions to Route51@WPR.org. Martin in Eau Claire sent an email and said, McKinley mentioned private student loan lenders might allow for some negotiation in loan repayment. Could you provide a little bit more advice on that? Like, for example, might lenders allow for partial or full interest accrual reduction, for example, if a 12-month full repayment plan is agreed on and executed? What kind of negotiation are we talking about?
Right. You just call the student lender up and just say, hey, here's my situation. They'll bring it up on their computer and they'll be able to see it and say, is there a way that I could lower my payment, or that I could reduce my interest rate, or do you have anything else out there that could help me get it? And the worst thing they can do is just say, no, you don't have any other options. And then you go, okay, great, I don't have any options. And you can either look for other alternative ways to pay it off, or you can just start making the payments on it. But definitely call your private lender. And then you may want to look around at other, you know, if you Google student loans or private student loans, you're going to find a million different providers out there. Call one of the other ones and say, if I were to consolidate my loans with you, what would the fees be? What would the interest cost be? And you know, again, federal loans are better than private student loans. You should not consolidate your federal loans into a private student loan. But if you already have a private student loan, you have more options out there that they'll compete against each other to try to get your money. And so the worst thing that they could say is no. So call them up and just ask them and say, what are my options with this money? And you'll find out some things probably that you weren't aware of.
Nanny from Phillips called, couldn't stay on the line, but wants to know if an insurance policy for a burial fund is a good idea or not. She had recently attended an event where a Texas company made a pitch for this kind of policy. You're laughing. Come on now.
Nothing about that sentence makes me feel good.
Okay.
Texas company made a pitch at an event. That's one of those, you know, the steak dinner thing really always worries me, because somebody's paying for that steak dinner. It's usually anybody who takes up the presenter's offer for help on it. You know, look, you'd be surprised. I know some people who are funeral directors, and they've said that, you know, those of us who have a couple nickels to rub together would be very surprised how few people can actually even cover the traditional burial cost of a loved one. I don't dislike it as a notion of saying, well, this will make sure that, you know, we can have a good funeral for grandma. Usually people who won't have the cash available to pay for that funeral also don't have the cash available to pay for the policy. And then when you do buy the policy, you're making a bet that the insurance company will be there to honor their obligation, and that you'll remember it, that, you know, if grandma buys it and it's in a record someplace and she dies, sometimes people say, well, I don't even know it, which, again, that's part of the beauty of the insurance, is the insurance company's counting on that when they price the insurance to you, that some people will just forget about it and not make the claim. You're counting on the notion that the dollar amount purchased will be large enough to cover whatever cost you want for the funeral. And so, and all insurance comes down to, does it make you feel good to have the policy? And can you afford it without damaging your financial resources otherwise? Then it makes sense. But otherwise, no, I wouldn't recommend it. And I really wouldn't want people to buy anything from some steak dinner event put on by a company in Texas.
So, Nanny, be careful, in other words.
Yes.
All right. I want to ask you about real estate. What's the situation like right now? Is it a good time to invest in a property now, given the current state of the housing market?
Well, right. And the great and terrible thing about housing is that it's a supply and demand issue, and there's a lot more demand than there is supply. And so even though interest rates have doubled and more so on long-term mortgages over the last couple of years, prices in many areas have not declined at all, because people still want to be able to buy houses. They're not building them fast enough. It's very difficult to get housing developments going right now in most areas. The labor is difficult to find. The materials are more expensive. All of this is contributing to much, much higher costs for it. And in terms of investing, you know, if you've never invested in real estate before and you have no expertise, it's a terrible investment. If you say, no, I've done this, or I've worked for someone who managed properties and did some construction work, or I'm buying a duplex, I know what I'm getting into, I like repairing toilets or whatever, it can be a great way to get rich very, very slowly. Otherwise, your best real estate investment is hopefully a house or a condo that you can buy with a 30-year mortgage. And yes, the interest rates are going to be over 7% on that 30-year mortgage. And then slowly pay it off and build up wealth over time. That's usually the best investment and only real estate investment that most people should pursue.
We're speaking with Kevin McKinley. The number to call, 800-780-9742, Route 51 at WPR.org. Hiring a financial advisor is one of the biggest financial decisions you can make. And I would imagine that a wrong recommendation could lead to some serious disaster. So what should people ask to be sure they're hiring somebody who's credible?
Well, I'm biased about this because I am one of these, but I believe that you should hire a fiduciary. And a fiduciary has a legal responsibility to act in your best interest first rather than theirs. And most registered investment advisors are fiduciaries. Just because you hire a fiduciary doesn't necessarily mean that that person will be good, nor does not hiring a fiduciary and some other kind of advisor mean that that person will be bad. But it's just a very good benchmark to start with. You also want someone generally who is fee-based rather than commission-based. And that's becoming more and more common these days, thankfully. But that means that the advisor has no financial incentive to make lots of transactions in your account. They get a fee. If you're happy with them, you keep paying the fee. Anytime you're not happy with them, they stop getting your fee, your annual fee. And then you can go on, look for another advisor, or do it yourself. And I would want the advisor also to be someone who specializes in your particular area of life, meaning that if you're starting out and you're planning a family, you'd want someone who has some knowledge about those things. If you're retiring, you want someone who has a lot of experience in handling retiring, not only in terms of moving money from your at-work sponsored retirement plan, but also managing cash flow. So you're getting all the money that is sustainable and that you can by paying as little in taxes and taking as little risk as you possibly can. And just know that, if you get a financial advisor, they generally are going to try to do what's best for you. That doesn't mean that everything's going to go up or it's going to go up a lot or anything, but just be more concerned about your financial security and transparency.
What do the different titles represent? What's the difference between a financial planner, a financial consultant, an advisor, a manager? Are they all the same or are there differences here?
They're fairly similar. It's a matter of semantics. Some people have, some letters after their name, like CFP is Certified Financial Planner Practitioner. Those people usually have more expertise and they've gone through some licensing and they're subject to a little bit more self-regulatory organization rules and bylaws. Again, it's kind of like a fiduciary. It helps, I think. It doesn't guarantee that that particular person with all the letters behind their name is going to be great, nor does it mean that a person without the letters is not going to be very good.
You're listening to Route 51. Our guest is Kevin McKinley. This is a discussion about making the most of your money, making sound financial investments for the future, and making the most of the rest of 2023. I'm Shereen Seewert. This is Route 51 on Wisconsin Public Radio. This is Route 51 on Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Shereen Seewert. Financial advisor Kevin McKinley is our guest today as we continue our conversation on smart money management. You can join the conversation too. Kevin will stay with us for the hour. You can email route51@wpr.org or join us by phone at 800-780-9742. Kevin, most of us want to retire someday, right? So how do you know how much retirement will cost? What's the best way to calculate that?
As a rule of thumb, I think we have in our practice, we have probably four or five different software programs where you can enter in all the data and make these projections and everything like that. And they always boil down to, you tell me how long you're going to live and how much you're going to spend each month, and I'll tell you if you're ready to retire. And so what I did is I came up with this super, super sophisticated formula. And I'm not sure, Shereen, if you're qualified to do this, but if you can, could you let the Nobel Prize Committee know about this? It turns out you can't nominate yourself. Aww. You have to have someone else do it. And I tried to get my wife to do it, and she
won't do
not
it.
Not interested at all. So it's not how much you make. It's not how much, you invest or how you invest or where it's invested. It's all predicated on how much you spend. And as hard as it is sometimes to cut your spending, it is much easier to spend less money than it is to make more.
Well, that's true. I mean, that's true. But for people who have struggled to put away retirement savings and they're worried they'll never be able to retire comfortably, what do you suggest for those people?
I'll start with the Roth IRA. You don't generally get a tax break on your Roth IRA when you put the money in, although certain lower income depositors can get a savers credit, which can be, several hundred dollars depending on your situation. The cool thing about the Roth IRA is you do not get a tax break on the deposit, but you can pull the contributions back out at any time for any reason with no taxes or penalties whatsoever. And when you pull it out for some kind of emergency, even if it's before age 59 and a half, you can designate that contribution as or the withdrawal as a contribution, and then you can leave the earnings portion in. Once you're 59 and a half, it's all tax free. So that's a real basic way to start without tying up your money and say, gosh, if I put $5,000 from my savings into this Roth IRA, I'm not going to be able to get at it until I'm 60, which might be 30 years from now. That's really tough for a lot of people to do, especially if you're, you know, like most people, you feel like you're in a financially insecure situation. So start with a Roth IRA.
What about a 401k? How do you decide how much to contribute to a 401k each paycheck? Is there a good benchmark to use?
Yeah, 10% is a really great number. Some people can't do that. You know, 10% of $50,000 is $5,000, and that's more than many people can afford to do. And so you at least want to get your employer's match if you possibly can. And then you can also decide, when you're trying to prioritize all this, let's go back to my formula here that we were talking about financial independence, because you can use it not only to decide if you're ready to retire, but how much you can spend in retirement, and then also measure out how you are doing along the way. So my formula is that you need 300 times your monthly expenses after your pension and Social Security before you can be considered financially independent. If you're spending $5,000 a month after your pension and Social Security, meaning $5,000 plus whatever you get from any pension or Social Security, and you're spending $5,000 a month, 300 times that amount is $1.5 million that you need to be financially independent. But if you're only spending $2,000 per month over and above your pension and Social Security, you need quite a bit less. Still a lot of money, but it's quite a bit less. It's $600,000.
Is there a maximum amount you can sock away in your 401k each year? I feel like there is.
Yeah, generally it's age dependent, and if you're over 50, you can put more. Usually it starts out around $20,000 for people under the age of 50. And as I mentioned, you know, if you think you need to check your finances, you can predicate your need to contribute more to your 401k by where you're at right now on your saving. If you're in your 30s, you probably need 50 times your monthly spending accumulated, again, above and beyond what you'll get from Social Security or a pension. If you're in your 40s, you should have about 100 times your monthly spending. If you're in your 50s, about 200 times your monthly spending. And again, if you're in your 60s, you're thinking about retiring, you should have about 300 times your monthly spending set aside after pension and Social Security. And again, that can sound like a lot of money. But for example, let's just say you've had a couple who has worked most of their adult lives. When they get into their 60s, they probably are going to be getting maybe a couple $1,000s each from Social Security. And that's $4,000 per month. Well, the average American household right now spends about $5,000 a month. So that couple would only need about an additional $300,000 set aside total before they can be comfortable that they are going to retire comfortably.
What if you need to withdraw those 401k funds early? What happens, and is it ever a good idea to do that?
Yeah, it can be a good idea. And in fact, if the fear of needing that money for some unknown expense is keeping people from getting at it in the future or from depositing, I don't let that be your fear. Unless you say, no, there's this thing I need to do in 6 months that's going to cost $10,000. Definitely don't contribute that money to a retirement plan. Otherwise, though, you can get out of 401k a lot of different ways. You can get a loan under many, many larger 401k retirement plans. You can borrow against the balance. There's no credit check. It doesn't affect your credit score. You usually can only borrow up to 50% of the value, or $50,000, whatever's less. But and again, not every employer offers that option within their 401k. So that's definitely one way to do it. Another way to do it is you can take a hardship withdrawal, where you get to say, I'm going to apply for this. I'm going to take the money out now. If you take it out before age 59 and a half, and unless it's for a qualified reason, usually like an emergency or healthcare expenses or something, you're not only going to pay taxes on that money, whatever you pull out, but you're going to pay a 10% penalty on that as well. So if you're still in a high income bracket, you can lose 30 or 40% of the value that you pull out of that 401k under a hardship withdrawal. And so if you pull out $10,000, you might only get about $6,000 back once the penalties and taxes come into play.
Kevin McKinley stays with us, and there is still time to call with questions, 800-780-9742, or email route51@wpr.org. Well, not every workplace has a 401k plan. You mentioned Roth. What are some other options that people should think about if they don't have a 401k?
Yeah, there, you know, there's probably about a third of employers do not have any kind of retirement plan. But the good news is that workers can still contribute a lot of money to their own self-directed IRAs or Roth IRAs that they can open up at, you know, the big providers like Vanguard, Fidelity, or Schwab. They can go to their local bank. They can try to find a financial advisor who will do that for them. But then you can contribute several thousand dollars a year into that plan, usually, you know, $7,000 or so, or your income, whichever is less. And if you're in a high income bracket, the IRA makes better sense, meaning if you make more than about $60,000 for a single filer and $120,000 for married couples filing jointly, the tax deduction of the IRA then really is a big benefit and makes sense. And again, if you can't afford to park the money aside forever or you're in a lower income bracket, the Roth IRA makes better sense. But with that amount of money, even if you're contributing just the maximum contribution, again, let's just say $7,000, you're contributing more to that account than the majority of people are contributing to their own retirement savings. So that's a really good benchmark if you can max out either the IRA or the Roth IRA to do that. And then if you're in a married couple, even if there's a stay-at-home partner who doesn't have any earned income, you can open up a spousal IRA, Roth IRA, and contribute the same amount of money that you did for yourself.
Hmm. You know, circling back to those calculations that you were talking about earlier, the calculations that you need to figure out what you need for retirement. What about inflation? I mean, are you including that in the cost of in your calculations? I mean, the cost of groceries keeps going up. So are you planning for that as well?
Yes, absolutely. And you know, we don't know what inflation will be. We don't know what returns be. Usually, as we're seeing in this last year or so, when you see rising inflation, you also see rising interest rates, which then can help you earn more money on your savings. Again, it costs you more on your debt if you're taking out a new loan. But yes, usually the net inflation adjusted works out with that rule of thumb, again, of having, you know, needing 300 times your net monthly expenses to be financially independent, no matter what age you might be, but especially in your late 50s or early 60s. And so, yeah, the inflation part about is in there. And one thing we do find is that especially for retirees, and most of our clients are in their 60s and beyond, and they're financially comfortable in part because of luck, in part because of being born at the right time. But we do find that their spending does not ratchet up 5 or 6 or 7% a year, even though inflation might be 5 or 6 or 7% every single year. Their spending goes up a little bit. They spend more on groceries and things, but you know, the rest of their lives usually they're not blowing through money very quickly. And that actually happens more so the older you get through retirement. We find that retirement spending is kind of like a smile. Rather than going up every single year until you die at age 90 or whatever, what it does is it spikes the first few years after retirement and then subsidizes as, you know, you've taken all the trips that you wanted to take, you've done every remodeling project that you wanted to do, and it actually goes down. And then it goes back up in the last few years of life just because you're spending more money on having someone care for you or out-of-pocket expenses for the doctor or assisted living or a nursing home.
Well, it won't be long before we're in the most expensive time of the year, the holiday season. So how can we prepare now to sail through the rest of the year and prepare for those expenses?
Yeah, try to understand that, you know, usually we get more satisfaction from buying things for people we care about than the people get from the actual item. So understand that, you know, throwing a bunch of money on something that might be thrown away a few weeks after the holidays is generally not a good investment. Try to avoid putting it on a credit card and pay only cash as a good rule of thumb. If you can afford to pay cash for something, you can afford it. If you can't, you can't. And so try to keep the dollar amounts low. Concentrate more on spending time with people. You know, some families have just said, you know, geez, carting all these gifts around, or worse yet, having them shipped from one house to another, it's just not worth it, especially when then a bunch of people have to bring them back to where they came from. And so if you just say, you know what, our expenses for Christmas are not going to be on gifts. It's going to be on gas to drive to your place, and it's going to be on a hotel room so that we're not burdening you by staying with you, and then we get some time. And then finally, it's going to be spent on ordering meals in so that we don't have to have someone do all the cooking and the cleanup and everything for it. That's a way better way for most people to spend the money rather than buying some gift that may or may not be needed.
Well, if we're planning to give financial gifts to family members, what are some of the annual gift tax exclusion limits we need to be aware of?
Those are paying the gift tax is a wonderful problem to have. Usually you can give $17,000-$18,000 a year to any particular person without filing a gift tax return in a given year. And then even if you need to give more to that, you don't have to pay gift taxes on it. You just have to file a return on it. And then that uses up some of your lifetime estate tax exemption, which as of now is close to $12 million per person. So technically you could give $12 million to another person and still not pay any gift taxes on that amount today. And again, if that's something you have as an option, you have no other financial problems. So it's not a big issue. And then also the recipient does not have to pay any gift taxes or income taxes on that gift either.
Really? Wow. Okay. Well, so for people who are planning to share some of their estate with family members, is it better to do it now or set up a will or trust for the future?
Yes.
Yeah. How's that for an ambiguous answer?
What we find is that, again, this is, just from 35 years of doing this with a lot of people who are in their 60s and 70s and say, you know what, our younger adult kids are doing their best, but they're still kind of struggling right now for all the reasons that we've been going over during this hour. And we'd like to help them out, but, should we give them money now or just leave it to them? And I am a big believer in when it's philosophically correct, you should give the money now, because $5,000 given to a 30-year-old is worth $50,000 left to a 60-year-old. It just means so much more when they're younger and they're struggling than it does when they're older and of a certain age and hopefully at a point of financial security. So try to give them the money now. Don't give big lump sums if you can help it. If, let's just say, you have a child who's struggling, can't find a job or staying home to take care of kids or other family members, say to them, hey, what amount per month would help you out right now? And they might say, well, $1,000 a month would really come in handy. And say, okay, I'll tell you what, I'm going to give you $1,000 every single month for 6 months. And then let's just revisit it there. Rather than giving them $6,000 and then having them try to manage the dollar amount, it'll just feel better and help them manage the income and the spending more when they know they're going to get $1,000 every single month. Another thing that people are doing, and again, you have to be of certain means to be able to do this, but they find out that their 30-year-old child has $15,000 in credit card debt, and they are finding out they're paying 26% interest on it. The parents will say, you know what, we've got $15,000. We're going to give you that money. You have to use it to pay off that balance, and then it can be a gift, or you can say, you know what, just pay us back $300 a month at 3% interest or something until you pay it off. And this is a one-time deal, so you're going to hopefully learn from your lesson and your mistakes and not make it again. And this, we're not going to bail you out again a second time.
Got about 2 minutes left in our time together. In some recent interviews, you've discussed what you call the single most important factor in achieving financial independence. What is it?
That is spending. That is, I always thought that when I was younger and looking at money, that it was important just to make as much as you possibly can. That's sure important. It sure helps. It's still easier to spend less money than it is to make more. So if you track your spending with an app like Mint, or You Need a Budget or Good Budget, and you find out what you can cut, it is so much easier to cut what you spend than it is to try to increase your earnings.
Well, I've got to wonder, are there any apps that you might recommend for setting a budget, sticking to a budget, anything that you've found works really well?
Yeah, the ones, the Mint and You Need a Budget and Good Budget are great. What also works, and I've seen some people a lot younger than you and me, Shireen, just write this down on a piece of paper and keep it in a journal, because yes, it requires more work. It's easier to backslide on it, but the manual effort of entering into it, it makes you really conscious of it rather than just seeing it electronically. And if you're fortunate enough to be in a committed relationship, you are very lucky, because you have someone who is dying to tell you on what you are spending too much money on.
I'm sure my husband's listening at home, nodding his head right now. Final last words. We have 30 seconds left. What other recommendations do you have for a best 2023 ever?
Four words: spend less, have more.
That sounds totally reasonable. Kevin, I want to thank you so much for being with us again. It's always so good to have you on.
Thank you, Shireen. I'm very lucky to be with you and talking with your listeners, so thank you for having me.
That is all we have time for today on Route 51. I'm Shireen Siewert. Once again, thanks to our guest, Kevin McKinley of McKinley Money LLC in Eau Claire and in Madison. Our producers today are Joy Ratch-Kramer and Rick Ryer. Rick is also our on-air producer today. Thanks to John Altenberg for the Route 51 theme. Special music today from Black Joe Lewis and the Honey Bears, Alo Bleck, Kenny Rogers, and the Beatles. You can hear the archive of today's program at WPR.org/Route51 and on your favorite podcast station. Join us next week for another fascinating Route 51 discussion on Wisconsin Public Radio. Thank you so much for being here.